Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're stepping away from the usual corporate metrics and market analysis.
Yeah, we're going somewhere much more intense.
Exactly. We're heading straight into the crucible of combat. Specifically, the Battle of Ramadi, Iraq, back in 2006.
Ramadi, yeah. At that time, it was widely seen as the absolute deadly epicenter of the Iraqi insurgency. I mean, U.S. forces controlled maybe a third of the city. It was pure chaos.
And our source material today comes directly from that environment. We're looking at lessons learned by Navy SEAL officers Jocko Willink and Leif Babin, who led Task Unit Bruiser there.
Mm-hmm. And these weren't theoretical lessons. These were forged in failure through immense loss and sacrifice. They form this kind of universal blueprint for leadership.
And that's really our mission today for you, the listener. How do we take these life or death military principles, principles developed when failure meant, well, catastrophe?
Catastrophic loss, yeah.
How do we translate that into a formula that works right now?
Yeah.
Whether you're running a huge company or, you know, just managing a really complex project at work.
And it all starts with one core, really non-negotiable idea.
Which is
extreme ownership.
Extreme ownership. Okay, break that.
It's the absolute foundation. What it means is, on any team in any organization, the leader is responsible for everything.
Everything.
Everything. Successes, failures, all of it. If the team fails to achieve the mission, the leader failed. Period. There's just no one else to blame. No excuses.
Wow. Okay, that sounds, honestly, it sounds almost unfair.
Yeah.
How can one person, the commander, truly be responsible for, say, every single mistake made by a junior guy in the middle of a firefight?
It feels that way initially, but you have to consider the alternative, which is usually a culture of blame and finger pointing.
Right.
This principle was really seared into their minds during a truly horrific incident, a blue-on-blue fratricide.
Friendly fire.
Exactly. A SEAL sniper team engaged an Iraqi soldier. They mistook him for an enemy combatant, a Muj, they called them, and this kicked off a massive firefight between friendly forces.
And reading the details, I mean, so many things went wrong all at once.
Oh, yeah.
You had what they call insufficient positive identification, PID, of the target.
Critical error.
The sniper team hadn't clearly communicated their exact location in all the chaos. And then you had these rogue Iraqi elements just wandering into the sector, completely uncontrolled.
Precisely. It was a cascade of failures. An Iraqi soldier was killed. A U.S. Navy SEAL was badly wounded by a friendly .50 cal round. So when the investigating officers show up,
yeah,
Task Unit Commander Leif Babin looks at this whole mess, all these tactical mistakes by his guys, and he just realized the only real failure was his.
So he didn't point fingers. He didn't say, well, the sniper didn't PID or comms failed.
He stood there and took total ownership.
Yep.
Told the investigators it was his fault. He fully expected and felt he deserved to be relieved of command, fired.
That's remarkable.
He actually contrasted it with training exercises he'd seen where, you know, weaker commanders would immediately start blaming their subordinates for simulated friendly fire. Babin understood something crucial.
Was that?
If he didn't own the mistake, the whole mistake, he couldn't possibly fix the underlying problems, the systemic issues in training or communication or procedures that allowed it to happen.
So owning it isn't about martyrdom. It's about seizing the power to fix it.
Exactly. It forces you to check your ego at the door completely. Because if you can't admit the failure, you give up your ability, your responsibility to prevent it from happening again. That humility, that's the core strength.
Okay, so once you accept that radical responsibility, what's next? How do you actually fix the team?
Well, that leads right into another really blunt principle. They hammer home something learned during SEAL training, DDS.
Which one is that?
There are no bad teams, only bad leaders.
Oof, that's direct.
It is. And they saw it proven dramatically during Hell Week. You know, the infamous IBS races, inflatable boats small.
Yeah, those brutal boat races.
Right. So there was this one boat crew the sixth. They were just constantly losing every race, getting punished relentlessly, totally demoralized. Seems like they'd just given up. Their leader was absolutely convinced he had the worst crew, just lazy guys.
But then the instructors did something interesting, right?
Yeah, a kind of experiment. They swapped the leaders. They took the leader of that failing boat crew, the sixth, and put him in charge of boat crew, the sixth, the guys who were winning everything.
And the winning leader went to the losing crew.
Exactly. The successful leader from boat crew, the second, took over the supposedly terrible boat crew sixth.
And what happened?
The change was, I mean, instantaneous, undeniable. Boat crew the sixth, same exhausted guys, same heavy boat, same awful conditions. They went from dead last to first place, started winning most of the races after that.
Wow. And the other crew, the previously winning one,
started failing. Under the poor leadership, their performance just cratered.
So the conclusion is stark. It was never about the individuals in the boat.
Never. It was the leader. Their attitude, their clarity, their ability to inspire, or lack thereof, that dictated everything. So the takeaway for you is, if your team is underperforming, the first place to look, it's in the mirror.
Starts and ends with leadership, okay? Yeah. So you own it, you assess your own leadership. How does the team itself function better together?
That brings us to a fundamental tactical concept, cover and move.
We hear that phrase, but what does it mean in this leadership context?
It's about active mutual support. Every part of the larger team has to work together, support each other to get the mission done. It means breaking down those internal silos we see everywhere.
Silos. Yeah, those are definitely familiar in the business world.
Oh, absolutely. They had this case study, a production manager. His department was stalled, production was down, and he just kept blaming a subsidiary company.
Right.
Now, the key thing is, this subsidiary was owned by the same parent corporation. They're technically on the same team. But this manager saw them purely as an obstacle, you know, an adversary slowing him down.
Wait, but if they work for the same overall company, they share the same ultimate goal, right?
You'd think so. But they were effectively working against each other. So the guidance given was blunt. Stop blaming. You need to engage with that subsidiary. Go talk to them.
Okay.
Explain clearly what you need from them, and critically, explain why it matters to the bigger picture. And then offer your team's help to solve their problems or resource constraints.
Ah, so shift from adversaries to partners. See them as a resource, not a roadblock.
Precisely. It's reframing the relationship. If you aren't actively working with them, you're failing your team. That shift in mindset from blame to collaboration, that's cover and move in action.
And result.
Dramatic improvement. Production downtime plummeted to, like, industry-leading levels because they were finally acting as one unified team, supporting each other.
That kind of seamless teamwork, though, it must depend heavily on clear communication.
Entirely. Which leads perfectly into the next two principles, both centered on achieving absolute clarity.
Let's start with simple.
Yes. The principle is just that. Keep things simple. Plans, orders, instructions. They have to be communicated simply, clearly, concisely. If your team, the people actually doing the work, don't understand it,
then you, the leader, failed to keep it simple.
Exactly. Complexity is the enemy, especially under pressure.
You see this in business all the time, don't you?
Constantly. Think about overly complicated bonus plans. We saw this manufacturing company where the bonus structure was just impenetrable.
No, sorry.
Employees might earn a bonus of like $423.97, or their performance was measured by some abstract metric like 0.84 improvement.
Nobody understands what that means in terms of their daily action.
Exactly. If the frontline worker can't clearly see how their specific actions directly lead to that reward or, you know, punishment, their behavior isn't going to change. The complexity just paralyzes understanding.
And the stakes are obviously much higher in combat. There's that anecdote about Jocko Willink advising an MPT leader in Ramadi.
Right, a military transition team leader working with Iraqi forces. This leader had planned out this incredibly complex patrol route.
Complex how?
Well, the initial plan sent the patrol through areas controlled by three different U.S. military units, three separate battle space owners.
That sounds like a coordination nightmare.
It was lethal complexity. It meant dealing with different radio frequencies, different chains of command. So imagine they take contact, they have casualties.
Requesting case evac. Casualty evacuation would be a nightmare. Maybe impossible.
Precisely. And on top of that, the complex route went through areas known to be heavily seeded with IEDs, roadside bombs.
So what was the fix?
Simplify. Drastically simplify the route. Cut down the number of units they had to coordinate with. Make it straightforward. That simple change massively reduced the risk of catastrophic failure.
Life or death consequences of complexity versus simplicity.
Okay.
So keep it simple. But what happens when things inevitably go wrong anyway, when complexity hits you?
That's where the next principle comes in. Prioritize and execute. When you're under pressure, problems tend to multiply. It feels like everything's on fire at once. The leader's critical job is to stay calm, detach a bit.
Detach.
Emotionally detach enough to clearly identify the single highest priority problem. What is the one thing that, if solved, will have the biggest positive impact right now?
Okay.
Then You focus all available energy and resources on solving that one problem, get it handled, and only then do you move to the next highest priority.
Don't try to fight on 10 fronts at once.
You can't. You'll fail on all of them. There's a great Geis example of this, a CEO of a pharmaceutical company. Mm. He was new, ambitious, smart, and he came in wanting to launch like 6 major initiatives simultaneously, a whole new product line, a complete website overhaul, restructuring the entire sales force, a massive new training program. You get the idea. All sound good on paper.
Sounds impressive, but also exhausting.
Exactly. He was spreading his resources, his team's focus, incredibly thin. Trying to do everything at once meant nothing was really gaining traction.
So the advice was?
Prioritize. Pick the one thing that will make the biggest immediate difference. In his case, it turned out to be improving the management and tracking of the sales force's daily activities. Focus everything there first.
But isn't that hard? Like, if you go to your board and say, our big plan is just focusing on sales activity tracking,
right,
while competitors announce 5 new products.
That's where leadership conviction is key. You have to explain why this prioritization is crucial. You argue that focusing on the most critical task allows the company to gain real momentum, achieve a win, and then build on that success to tackle the next priority from a position of strength.
So win one battle before starting the next 5.
Basically, yes. Ambition without focus is just chaos. By prioritizing, that CEO got the whole company aligned, they achieved quick, measurable wins in sales performance, and then they had the capacity and momentum to tackle the next big project.
Okay, that makes sense. Focus is power. So we've covered individual responsibility, team dynamics, and clarity. How do you manage the whole system, especially as it gets bigger?
That brings us to decentralized command.
Decentralized command. Sounds like delegation, but more intense.
It is. It starts with a simple reality check. Human beings just aren't designed to effectively manage more than, say, 6 to 10 people directly, especially not in chaotic, high-stress situations. It's too much information, too many moving parts.
So what's the solution?
You have to break down larger teams into smaller, manageable elements. In the SEAL teams, that meant fire teams of maybe 4 to 6 operators.
Okay.
And then, this is the crucial part, you have to truly empower the junior leaders of those smaller teams. They need the authority and the trust to make rapid decisions on the ground, in the moment.
Based on what, though? How do they know they're making the right decision?
Based on their understanding of the overall mission goal, the commander's intent. If they clearly understand the why behind the mission, they can make smart tactical calls that align with the bigger picture, even when things change rapidly.
That sounds like it requires a huge amount of trust, giving junior people that much leash in a high-stakes environment.
It does. But the alternative centralized control where every decision flows up and down is too slow and brittle. There's a chilling example of why decentralized command is life-saving. It involves a near-fratricide incident in a place called the J Block.
What happened?
A U.S. Army Bradley Fighting Vehicle commander spotted what he thought were enemy snipers in a specific building, Building 79. He was preparing to engage them with the Bradley's heavy cannon.
Okay.
The problem. Delta Platoon SEALs were confirmed to be operating out of Building 94, which was just down the street. Very close.
Oh, no. Potential misidentification.
Huge potential. Now, the SEAL platoon commander on the ground, a junior leader, was operating under decentralized command. He didn't have to wait for permission from higher up to clarify his position.
He was empowered.
Right. He immediately got on the radio and confirmed his team's location in Building 94, 100%, he said. Meanwhile, someone back in the Tactical Operations Center, the TOC, monitoring the radio traffic, noticed the discrepancy between the Bradley report and the SEAL report. They quickly realized the Bradley crew had simply miscounted the buildings in the dark and the chaos. They were actually looking at and about to fire upon the SEALs in Building 94.
Wow.
That junior leader, empowered by decentralized command to act immediately and confirm his position without delay, prevented those 25-millimeter high explosive rounds from hitting friendly forces. The structure, the trust, saved lives.
That's incredible. The trust flowed down and enabled the right action at the lowest level.
Absolutely. And that trust relationship, it has to flow both ways. Which brings us neatly to the final core principle.
Which is?
Leading up the chain.
Leading up the chain. We usually think about leading down.
We do. But effective leaders also need to manage their relationship with their own bosses. Leif Babin actually talks about being incredibly frustrated with his higher headquarters in Ramadi.
Why was that?
He kept getting these emails, which he found kind of insulting, asking things like, have you coordinated a quick reaction force before every single operation? He felt like his commanders didn't trust him, like they were micromanaging.
I can see how that would be frustrating.
Totally. But Jocko Willink gave him a different perspective, a crucial reality check.
What did he say?
He explained that if your boss isn't making the decision you need, or if they keep asking repetitive, seemingly obvious questions, it's not their fault. It's your fault as the subordinate leader.
How is it the subordinate's fault?
It means you haven't done a good enough job of providing them with the necessary information and situational awareness. You haven't made them comfortable.
So the onus is on the person lower down the chain to manage upwards effectively.
Yes. You have to proactively and tactfully push situational awareness up the chain. Your boss has their own boss, their own pressures. They need clarity and confidence to approve your plan or support your needs.
So it's about putting the boss in their comfort zone.
Exactly. By providing clear, concise, proactive updates, anticipating their questions, and demonstrating you've thought through the risks and contingencies, you earn their trust. That's how you lead up and get the support you need to accomplish your mission.
What an incredible arc. We started in the absolute chaos of Ramadi, saw the cost of failure, the immense sacrifice.
Yeah, losing incredible people.
And we end up with this really clear, powerful set of principles. Extreme ownership as the foundation.
Then realizing there are no bad teams, only bad leaders.
The need for cover and move.
Yeah.
Breaking down silos.
Keeping things simple. Avoiding lethal complexity.
The discipline to prioritize and execute when under pressure.
Empowering your team through decentralized command.
And finally, understanding how to lead up the chain effectively.
It really defines leadership at the highest level, doesn't it? The principles themselves, they sound simple, but living them, executing them consistently day in and day out, that requires relentless discipline and absolute commitment. It's simple, but it's definitely not easy.
Which leads perfectly to our final thought for you, the listener. Something to carry forward.
Yeah.
It ties directly into decentralized command and, really, mentorship.
Hmm.
Jocko and Leif suggest that the ultimate goal of any leader should be to work themselves out of a job. Meaning, if you truly embrace extreme ownership and you truly practice decentralized command, how consciously are you mentoring and developing your subordinates today? Are you preparing them so well that they could actually step up and take over your most critical functions tomorrow?
Ah, so that you are then freed up to focus on the next bigger challenge, the next level of strategic thinking and growth.
Exactly. Are you building leaders who can replace you? That kind of deliberate empowerment and mentorship.
That's how you build a truly resilient, winning culture that can actually sustain itself and scale. Something to really think about next time you delegate or maybe hesitate to delegate. It's a critical task.
Indeed. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
Great discussion.
We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.